The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Care and protection for the whole family's health at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. I just remembered to take off my mask there before I started talking. How institutionalised have we all become at this stage? So the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday today, you could be mistaken for thinking you're looking at the English version of the Mail on Sunday. A roadmap to freedom. Very Barrassy boosterish. So they have what they say is a fairly well-informed roadmap to freedom here. And all retail is due to resume by the second week of May. Inter-county travel ban ends in early June, and a lot more there. We'll come back to that in a minute. The Sunday Independent have Varadkar quizzed by Gardaí over leak, and Leo Varadkar was questioned by Gardaí, I think, last Friday week. They also took possession of his mobile phone, and in what the Independent are calling an upscaling of the investigation. And on April 5th, Matthew O'Toole met the Gardaí by arrangement, and he provided a voluntary statement. Now, the Sunday Times has that same story. They also say, by the way, that Matthew O'Toole and Leo Varadkar were told their phones will not be returned until a decision is made on whether they will face charges. And it is understood that Varadkar has privately complained about this. They also say their Garda sources believe it's doubtful he'll face prosecution, that it is it's a minor breach of data protection regulations. Isn't it gas? It's almost as if we were in the room for the two interviews, and we are, not only do we have that, but we have judge, jury, director of public prosecutions, all bypass there, and we have the final outcome. The Business Post: insurers facing a new round of legal action as more businesses sue over COVID. There's an interesting kind of sideline to that story as well, which is that the insurance companies, when paying out, have been deducting the trying to deduct the state supports that the businesses got. So effectively, as they're saying here, we have a situation where the state is subsidising the insurance payouts. They also have Martin reveals hospitality sector will get a big stimulus plan. Hopefully it'll be more successful than the last one. And then all the tabloids leading on that very sad story of Jenny Poole, that 25-year-old woman who was stabbed in front of her son yesterday. That's the front of the Sun. And the Sunday World has it as well. And the Mirror has it too. And then most of the English papers carry a photograph of the Queen sitting alone at her husband's funeral yesterday. And it was, I don't know if you watched it, it was an extraordinary funeral, and you're reminded they do these things so well. But I think that image of the Queen there alone, bent over at some stages so you could just see black, I think it will be an iconic historic image in years to come. Anyway, let's meet our panel. Luke O'Neill needs no introduction. He's an immunologist at Trinity College Dublin. Christine Finn is political correspondent with the journal.ie, and Pat McCann is the CEO of Delato Hotel Group and a former president of IBEC. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning.
Now, we'll start, I think, with that opening up of the country. And Christine, would you talk us through what the Mail have there today?
Yeah, so the front page of the Daily Mail is kind of one of those things we're quite familiar with, another roadmap for reopening and what we might expect heading into the summer. So obviously we're in level five. They're going to be discussions towards the end of the month in relation to what exactly we can expect in May, and we'll also get some sort of insight about what the rest of the summer will look like. So we're looking at retail for the second week in May. I think that will be welcome to a lot of people. And then intercounty travel is being flagged for June, which is something I'd been told myself. So I think that's sort of looking towards the hospitality sector. You know, we see in the Business Post that interview with Micheál Martin saying they're going to need significant support heading into the summer.
I think people will be interested that personal services, hairdressers, barbers, etc.
Let's not forget about them.
Yeah, week three in May. So that's a big one for people. And then June, we're looking at outdoor dining and then gradually indoor dining as well, yeah?
Yeah, I think we're kind of following similar sort of line to what the UK are doing. I was told we're about 4 to 6 weeks perhaps behind the UK. So those great jolly scenes that we see in the last week, we're all looking at them quite jealous at the moment. But we should be hopefully getting to that point sometime within the summer. I think it's interesting in the roadmap that was released, there is a bit more room in terms of how hospitality might work. There's a lot more talk about capacity and the likes of that and you know, households that can sit together. I think
so we'll be back into all that stuff again.
Yeah, maybe. And I think we're going to see that
time
debate.
Time limits and all of that.
Well, you know. I wonder whether we'll be going down to time limits. I know the 9 euro meal is something that we debated vigorously last summer. It's one that I asked Micheál Martin about myself. He had said that he wasn't in favour of it before in an interview with myself. So
I would like to say that he told me in an interview as well that he thought it was a bad idea and it should never have happened.
But I do think that businesses at this point, we've already heard a lot of calls from publicans, restaurants. They need a bit of certainty about how they're going to reopen, because this isn't just about switching a light switch on. You know, they need to have preparations in place. And if food is going to be a requirement, they're going to need to have kitchen facilities and all that up and running.
And, so, and trying to get their staff back
exactly.
As well, which is apparently proving problematic in certain situations. Luke, is this hubris here, this to be planning into May, June, July?
No.
We have full reopening of society complete by week 4 in June there.
That's reasonable.
Is it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're following the UK, as Christine said, by the way. We're sort of 4 to 6 weeks behind them. Going very well over there. The vaccination campaign is delivering. I mean, the numbers are amazing. 97% decrease in cases there, 98% decrease in deaths, you know, since the peak.
Yeah, but they have been in a fairly strict lockdown as well. And Boris Johnson seems to be suggesting that the lockdown is contributing more than the vaccinations at this point.
It'll be part of it, for definite. But we know from Israel as well and the US that the vaccines are working and protecting people, which is the main thing, you see. So it's great for us. And as I say, we're just a few weeks behind them. And even if it is lockdown, you know, that might be part of it. But I'm sure the vaccine is a major reason for the numbers going in the right direction.
And you know, this discussion that's going on in the UK as well, I think some of the independent sage people are saying there will be some kind of a surge in the summer. It practically guaranteed if the opening up happens.
One prediction is it'll become like another infectious disease that's around. You know, there'll be little spikes here and there, you know, and eventually we'll see the odd outbreak. And during the summer, we will see one or two little blips as we go along, you know. Hence, we've got to keep up with the dreaded social distancing and the usual guidelines. We can't completely go mad, you see. So the summer will have to be a period of carefulness. There's no question about that.
Okay.
But a lot of relaxation, though, to allow us to begin to get back to normal.
Okay. And you're out today with ideas about vaccination. We might come back to that in a minute. Guys, put on your headphones there because Pat McCann is remote from us. Pat, did it give you heart when you saw that that laying out there in black and white of how things might open up over the summer?
Yeah, it's very welcome. If it's true, that's the other question, of course, and that it's not just speculation, because the last thing we want at this point in time is speculation. And what we would like to see is that the powers that be would confirm that this is a possibility. And we do know things have to change from time to time. But essentially, what the population needs, but equally, I suppose, businesses need as well, is some level of certainty as to when we can start the roadmap out of here. And Luke did mention there about the vaccinations. And if you look at the effect of vaccinations in our nursing homes and in our frontline health workers, how that has prevented both infection and obviously serious illness. So I think there has to be a lot of encouragement taken out of the vaccinations. But equally, as Luke said, that we will have to maintain our discipline for a number of months, that we can't go mad. And nobody wants that to happen either.
Yeah, and look, I don't know. I think there's this, we bandy around that people went mad. Like, I don't know how mad most people went. But that's interesting that, and to what Christina was saying as well, you're basically accepting in the hospitality industry, are you, that it's not going to be normal, even if you do get to open up, that there will be a lot of rules. And I suppose a bit the way things were last summer, like that there was a certain, not quite a hospital atmosphere around places, but that places had an overlay, if you will, of sanitation and COVIDity, you might call it, around.
Yeah, but I do think there's an acceptance that what we had last year and particularly at the beginning of January and over Christmas, that we wouldn't want a repeat of that. But equally, what we do need to see is where there's, I suppose, an acceptance that we're in a very different place. And as the vaccinations roll out, we'll continue to be in an equally different place than we were back at the end of 2020 and the beginning of 21. So I'd be much more, I suppose, hopeful that what we'll see when we do reopen will be a little bit more liberal and allow more freedom within the various sectors that have been shut down for so long now.
Yeah. Do you think are people accepting that there will be limitations on things like numbers, that there'll be possibly, remember the whole argument about 2 metres, 1.5 metres, all that, that things will be a bit curtailed in the sector?
Yeah. So one of the things we're looking at this point in time is how many people we'll actually take into our hotels. Will we limit the numbers of sleepers, for example? They're questions we're asking ourselves at this point in time. We don't want to be in that place, but it may be that if we have too many people, let's say, staying, that would cause a problem. So we just need to look at all of the issues that will face us as we start to reopen. Ironically, from a Dalata point of view, if we got permission to open today, we are ready to open tomorrow. It'll be that quick for us because we are still operational for frontline and essential workers.
Okay. I'm a bit kind of thrown there by that you call your guests sleepers in hotels. It sounds like something from a science fiction film, like you drug them up into a coma and put them into a drawer or something. How many sleepers have we tonight?
Well, it's an important statistic because you see, in normal circumstances, what you have is if you have a lot of business clients, it tends to be single occupancy. So essentially you have one sleeper. If you have a family, on the other hand, that could be 4 or 5 sleepers. So you do need to make that statistic. It's a very important one when you're trying to manage within the current environment.
Okay, now, as we alluded to earlier, this is all kind of contingent on vaccine rollout. And Luke, you're out today, not only in your own column in the Sunday Independent, you're in the Business Post with Rachel Lavin as well. And your big idea now is that we spread out that gap and that we spread it out for Pfizer-BioNTech as well. Will you just take us through your thesis?
Well, again, the dreaded phrase is based on data, Brendan. You know, I mean, the one shot of Pfizer gives 80% protection. Same with Moderna. One shot of AstraZeneca gives 76% protection. This is very high percentages from a single shot.
So we know both higher than Johnson & Johnson?
They are. Now, rather strangely.
Okay, will you explain that to me?
Yeah, Johnson & Johnson is 66 to 72%, and that is a one-shot vaccine. You know, so they're performing like the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Did they ever
try,
and just we'll come back to the main point in a minute, did they ever try a second dose of Johnson & Johnson?
They're doing it, yeah. They're doing a trial anyway to get it even
higher.
How
did they get to be allowed to be a one shot? And then, was it stupid of Pfizer to make it a two shot? Did they have a better one shot vaccine than Johnson & Johnson?
You could see it that way, yeah. I mean, Johnson, they said we're doing a one shot trial, and there's our data, Pfizer and Pfizer, a two shot trial. So it's the way trial design is what that is, really.
Okay, anyway, now, back to your point.
But if that's the case, that this single shot's giving great protection, the UK, remember, 32 million people, only 8 have had 2 shots, you see. And we think the vaccine is performing very well. They're notwithstanding the lockdown part of that discussion we just had. But still, it's working as a one shot approach. Finland.
Yeah, no, they're mainly AstraZeneca, aren't they?
Which 20 million AstraZeneca.
The gap there is allowable up to
12 weeks.
12 weeks,
see,
okay.
Yeah, 12 weeks. So if you're an immunologist, it's well known you give 2 shots and you can have a wide gap between the first and second. So 3, 4, 5 months sometimes is used because the immune system then really kicks off 3 months later, you know. But now that we know the one shot is giving protection, it's very wise now to get that first shot out as quickly as possible. And Rachel Lavin, you mentioned her, she interviewed me before she got these numbers and she reveals them today. If we put all the first shot out, we'll reach Micheál's target of 80% by the end of May. Okay, so it'll speed up the process if we release all the one shot. Then you do need the second shot. It is important because that really kicks off the immune system and might give you years of protection. The main function of the second shot actually is to get a durable response that might go on for months and months and months. So you might delay it by up to 12 weeks in the UK. They have a 12-week gap, for instance. You know, they're talking about, I see in the Independent today, 8-week gap, which is sensible. Just extending it to an 8-week gap will allow a lot more people to be vaccinated more quickly is the idea, you see. And then you're reaching a level of protection in the community. And the virus is still out there, remember. So you want to get as many people protected as quickly as you can, and one shot can achieve that.
Okay, can I ask you a couple of questions? One, being the kind of practical one, which I'd say is on people's minds, is that nobody will be getting a vaccine passport on one shot, will they? Or nobody will be getting the vaccine bonus on one shot?
That's the next thing to be debated. Okay. There will be pressure on that, though. Yeah, why not? Yeah. I mean, that would be one argument, you see. So I think we still need to be slightly cautious with all this, by the way. But wouldn't it be tremendous, Brendan, if by the end of May, 80% of our adults have had one shot that's giving over 75% protection? That's a great thing to achieve, you see. And there's no doubt then the virus is on the run. As we know from Israel and the US, the vaccine is protecting people and stopping severe disease and stopping transmission, more importantly, as well. So okay. It's all heading in that direction.
And the other question I want to put to you is, you'll have seen in Rachel Lavin's piece as well, Jerry Killeen taking issue with the idea of one shot, because he's saying a half vaccinated population, that is basically offering a breeding ground for variants that would escape vaccines, because they're more likely to develop in that environment.
That is a concern, for definite, but it's minimal, right? If you ask, again, immunologists, they say there's very low chance of that happening. Previous vaccines, like measles, sort of have not done that. They haven't given rise to variants, you see. So there's a very tiny chance of that happening, and it's a risk worth taking, let's put it that way, would be the view.
Okay, and a good few people texting in to ask, and you've actually explained this before, but what does 80% protection mean?
It just means decreased risk of getting infected. So you're decreasing your risk by 80%, which is a substantial decrease in risk, remember. And more importantly, Brendan, there's two things you measure with vaccines. One is the decreased risk of getting infected, but probably more importantly, not developing severe disease. And they're all 100% efficacious anyway, that it looks like. So you've got, they're very protective. These vaccines are the biggest advance in medicine in 100 years, remember. And we're all falling off our seats with how they're performing in the field. Israel, the US, spectacular data that these vaccines are fantastic things, you see. So it gets stronger all the time, the evidence that this is working, basically.
Okay. Christina, are you hearing where the thinking is at as regards the government are looking at opening the gap up a bit more, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely for the Pfizer vaccine and a few others, they're contemplating what the argument is, as Luca said, what sort of benefits we might get from it. There are concerns about, obviously, people aren't fully vaccinated until they have perhaps the two doses, and what that might mean for these vaccine bonuses and what that might mean for travel. But I think last week the government was really thrown off its path in terms of those two big announcements about AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Obviously, good news they got from the Ursula von Leyen about what we might be getting in terms of the increase in the Pfizer vaccine. But yeah, it just looks like everything is sort of on the table for consideration in terms of what way they're looking to rejig the rollout of this. And we saw that yesterday with this Stephen Donnelly's quotes about the 18 to 30, which has, you know, caused a lot of debate and discussion about who gets what first.
That went well, didn't it?
Very well, yeah. But I was told basically it was like the minister was thinking out loud that you couldn't prioritise people that were least likely to get sick. But then obviously the flip side of that argument is perhaps younger people have sacrificed more and given up more of their lives over the last year than perhaps people of my own age. You know, I think he runs the risk of I think, creating a conversation as we get into this about the divisions and, you know, the two-tier society. We're talking about it already, about travel and certs and who's going to be allowed to do what. So I think we are running the risk of perhaps overcomplicating things. The government were pretty clear that they wanted to stick to NIAC's advice about the age. It seemed to be the simplest way to do it and just get it done quickly.
Yeah. Pat, you're a management kind of person, and you've managed big projects and big organisations. Mm-hmm. Was that another example yesterday of just bad communication, chopping and changing, spreading uncertainty and getting people anxious and everything?
It's exactly that. And I think it gives a sense of kind of making it up as you go along. And I think there's a danger in that, because then you confuse people. And if you remember back only a few weeks ago, we had the teacher issue. And if you look at teachers, they would fall into that probably 30 to 50 year category. So I can imagine the furore that would come as a result of that. So politically and in every sense, it really was not the best approach to an issue that needed to be dealt with in a more concise and, I suppose, structured manner.
Yeah, so, Luke, should we stick with the age thing now? Or is there an argument that if you have protected all the most vulnerable, older people and people at risk or high risk, that then actually you jump down and start hitting young people?
Well, he didn't say anything wrong there, Stephen Donnelly, remember. I mean, he's right in the sense that if it's transmitting a lot in that population, why not vaccinate them and stop it transmitting, you see? And that's a sensible thing to say. But it was thinking out loud, I guess, as Christina said, because...
They should be looking all the time, shouldn't they, as things move on?
But they shouldn't say it until they've decided, Ben.
that's probably the best way
to put it, you know.
Yes,
and you got to go with the age.
Yeah, well, he had only asked for them to look into
it. Yeah, but then they hammer him.
Well, talking to the Irish Times about it possibly wasn't the best idea.
Exactly.
Listen, Luke, Justine McCarthy is writing in the Sunday Times today that we are making guinea pigs of the 60 to 70 year olds and that it's all wrong. And look, people are still texting in today their questions about AstraZeneca, from should I get it when I've recently had a heart attack to shouldn't the over 60s be getting the most efficacious vaccines, etc., etc. Where are you standing on the AstraZeneca?
Yeah, when we write the story of this, which will be written eventually, Ben, and we'll say what the hell happened here with AstraZeneca, because it's been a terrible story and it's causing massive anxiety, consternation. I get about 30 emails a day from people worrying about that vaccine now for obvious reasons. And it's understandable, isn't it? You know, because obviously it's got a bad press. There's fear over clotting and all these various things. The first thing to say is you've got to give it to the over 60s. They're very high risk of severe disease. This is a very safe vaccine. So you start with that and say it's appropriate that that group should be given this vaccine. They look like guinea pigs, don't they, though, because they're now being singled out. In the UK, it's over 30s. I would support that for definite, by the way. And Paul Moyne, in fact, one of my old colleagues, he was interviewed today. He said, give it to all the over 30s, you see, because if you're
But the people that this happened to, a lot of them were over 30, weren't they?
They were, but it's the risk of the disease, you see, versus being harmed by the vaccine. It's that balance the whole time, you know.
And then equally, the argument that Karina Butler made and Nayak would make is that when there are other vaccines, you don't need to take that. If we'd no other vaccine, shove the AstraZeneca into everyone. But when you have options, don't let people take that
risk. What the Danes have done, remember. The Danes have said, we've loads of Pfizer, we've loads of Moderna, we don't need that vaccine. That's a sensible thing to say, isn't it? Because they've got the pristine one, haven't they? We don't have that. But there's no doubt that AstraZeneca is a very safe, efficacious vaccine, approved by the EMA and the MHRA, very careful people to keep using it. You know, so you're cutting this bind, you know. And if you say to someone, you have a 1 in a million chance of dying from this vaccine, some will say, I'm not having that. I'm not going to take that vaccine. I'm not going to take that risk, you know. Although that's a very remote possibility. So it creates some anxiety, basically.
Yeah, it's funny how we can focus so much on... I saw Australia reported their first death in connection with AstraZeneca. And I was like, oh, God, that'd give you the willies. And then I realised that they had reported how many deaths from COVID the night before in the news. And I'm kind of inured to that at this stage. Yeah. So I suppose this risk is far away and this risk is bigger or whatever. It's the Father Dougal thing. Yeah. Christina, there's a very... I think it's an odd story on the front of the Sunday Times that about the church and the stance they're taking on this. I think a lot of people might find it odd. Can you just tell us the story?
Yeah, so the front page of the Sunday Times has a headline, Archbishops Attack Minister's Ban on Mass. So basically, four archbishops are considering taking legal action over the state basically signing regulations that it's a criminal offence to have some sort of religious mass being held. So this has kind of been rumbling on over the last couple of weeks in terms of people that have wanted to go to their religious services. We've had reports of priests that have been going against that advice. You know, basically the archbishops are saying that this is a potential infringement of their religious freedom and their constitutional rights. And we also have a court case being taken from Declan Ganley in relation to this. But I think it does speak to the wider debate, basically, of what is law and what is public health guidance, which has been significantly fudged throughout this pandemic. And there's two law professors actually in Trinity, David Kenny and Oran Doyle, have been looking closely at the religious aspect of this and whether masses and services can be held. And there was a lot of talk about whether it was actually an offence, was it actually a law, or whether it was just public health advice. And what has seemed to have transpired from the Sunday Times article is that regulation making it a criminal offence was signed into effect only last week. So obviously that brings bigger questions about what's been going on over the last number of weeks about why.
And this is not the first time there's been that confusion between what is banned and what is advised against.
The Trinity professors did a really good blog during the week, and it was sort of deep diving into different aspects of what we're being told is an offence and what isn't. So things like, you know, meeting outdoors, then we have a little caveat added onto that, that you can't meet someone in your back garden. But that's not actually in the law or the regulation. We also had Micheál Martin coming out telling us, forget about those takeaway points, they're done. That wasn't actually a law. Yeah, that was just an opinion that was given from himself, which resulted in publicans stopping doing that because, you know, they thought that it was going
well,
to
Well, in fairness, I think they've got their mojo back
but
on
I
the takeaway
the,
points
from
now.
From the beginning of this, a lot of TDs in the Dáil were signing up to government legislation that severely restricts our freedoms over the last year. And they did it on the basis that there'd be transparency and openness about what that meant. Yeah, and I just don't think throughout the last year, the fudging of this, these regulations, of the laws, of signing of regulations, perhaps, you know, under the radar, it just... It doesn't bring people along with you. It makes people sceptical of things, as you said, being made up as we go along. And I just don't think it serves the public very well this time.
OK. But by the way, just before we go to a break, Pat McCann, I should have asked you, I presume you'll be at some stage in the firing line to get an AstraZeneca, that the day will come soon enough when you can log on and sign up. Will you be signing up and taking it?
I have breaking news on this, Brendan. I registered on Thursday. And on Friday evening, myself and my wife, Anne, were sitting having dinner, and I got a text to say that my first jab is on Tuesday morning at 11:45 in City West. And I am delighted to be there and have no issues with AstraZeneca.
OK, and your wife is getting a jab too, I hope.
She will.
Some of us are straddling the generations. Those of us with younger wives are now finding that it could be problematic. We could be going on holidays on our own the autumn.
She can register on Monday and she'll be doing that.
OK, excellent. All right, listen, our panel staying with us, Luke O'Neill, Christina Finn and Pat McCann, and we'll take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Luke O'Neill, Christina Finn and Pat McCann. Luke O'Neill, you just telling us there in the break, you haven't got a vaccination.
No.
You were offered one?
I was. I don't work in the hospital. My lab is on Pear Street.
Anyone who ever walked into a hospital in their life or did a bit of plumbing or carpentry in there has a vaccination at this stage.
Well, we have our COVID centre, remember, in Trinity. Let's give it a plug. Three people in my lab go to the hospital, get samples. They got vaccinated.
Okay.
The rest of us said, no, we were offered it actually, but we said that because we're not on the front line. It would have been Pfizer, actually. Yes.
Okay.
That was a few weeks ago. But
you must be one of the few people now who didn't jump at it, but fair play. Listen, they'll be texting you now, oh, that Luke O'Neill,
yeah,
I thought he was amazing enough as it is, and now look at him. Oh, yeah, of course, on the other hand, they'll be, Luke O'Neill knows well. He won't have that poison in him. Okay, the other big issue of the week was the ongoing... rollout, or whatever you want to call it, or falling apart of mandatory quarantine. And Tony O'Brien, who's the former chief executive of the HSE, joins us now on the line. And Tony, you're writing in the Business Post today, and you're basically saying this mandatory hotel quarantine is set up to fail, basically. The first point you're making is this should be managed by border control.
Yeah, Brendan, I think it's extraordinary given the amount of challenges that the Department of Health has to deal with, most important of which right now is the vaccine rollout that you've been talking about. But in this country, we expect the Department of Health to manage border quarantine. Yeah, sure, they need to be the ones who advise on which countries should be in or out, but the practical implementation of it seems to me, as in other countries, should be left to those whose main focus is around travel and around border control. So it's not a great basis. It's not a good thing to keep this on the shoulders of the department or the minister.
And you write in the piece about your own experiences of travelling, and I know they were sad circumstances, and my condolences on that. But you've had occasion to travel into Heathrow quite a bit recently. And like, we talk here as if we're the only country in Europe that is doing anything about any kind of quarantine or border control, and as if, you know, we're leading the world here. But tell us about your experience of arriving into Heathrow, which is actually sounds much more security, biosecurity conscious than arriving into Ireland in ways.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for your condolences. Yeah, as you arrive, I've been with Aer Lingus into Heathrow's Terminal 2 a few times, and as you arrive at the jetway, you're met literally by a phalanx of border control officers who are effectively police officers. They check every passenger. They check documentation. They're looking to, because of the common travel area, if you're coming from the Republic of Ireland and you haven't been anywhere else for the last 14 days, you can travel freely into England. And they're looking to ensure that those of us on the plane hadn't been anywhere else. There is something called the Dublin Dodge, where certain British residents seem to try to get into Britain without going through mandatory hotel quarantine by coming to Ireland first, and they're checking passports. It's also evident, in terms of people not coming from the common travel area, that they're going through very rigorous checks. The staff there were pointing to literally hundreds of suitcases on the edge of baggage delivery systems left unclaimed while passengers were going through fairly rigorous checks to prove not only that they'd had a pre-travel PCR test, but that they had two more booked, proof of the address they were going to, and so on. And then other passengers who were destined for mandatory hotel quarantine being escorted through it and taken on accordingly by the border force. So the regime there seems to be pretty strict. And I noticed also that when Northern Ireland made its decision on Friday to implement mandatory hotel quarantine, it's not that it's going to be implemented some weeks away. It's being implemented effectively tonight. There is an issue, I think, about the speed between making a decision
And allowing all the people to change their flights and get in beforehand, basically.
Yeah, I mean, if these things are being done, as we understand, because there's a public health imperative to do it, then you'd expect to see a degree of urgency. In England, it was 8 days between decision and implementation. Northern Ireland, it's across the weekend. And here we saw weeks and weeks. And then most recently, we saw that 10-day hiatus, the debacle over whether or not to include certain EU countries and Canada and the United States and so on. And again, if the evidence is there, if it's evidence-based, why the delay?
You know the way, so there was this great clamour to have it, right? And then, like, the first plane had barely landed, then somebody was on to Clareburn on behalf of their poor family, and we had people on television over the first weekend of it from their rooms and everything, and then everybody was suddenly feeling sorry for them. Now people demanding more and more exemptions and everything. Would you agree with the likes of Gabriel Scally, who say, like, I thought the point of it in Australia and New Zealand was that if you do this, you have to go for it, and it has to be really tight, and it's tough, but there you go. Would you agree with Gabriel Scally that, like, either don't do it at all, or we need to do it in a much more kind of less messy fashion, and we have to stop all these exemptions and feeling sorry for people and special pleadings and stuff?
Well, I think you have to do it seriously, but I also think you have to have some area for humanitarian compassion as well. So that if a person is coming literally to be at the bedside of a dying parent, there's little point suggesting that they should first remain in a hotel for 12 days. So I think that you do have to mix compassion with a hard edge, although in general, I think the rules should be the rules. And, you know, I recognize that people are always going to have niggles about having their plans interrupted or having to stay in a hotel. But ultimately, it's not, except in rare cases, it's not a particularly huge hardship if you're making that decision to travel in the first place. You generally do so with your eyes open. Now, obviously, I was fortunate I didn't have to do that because I was coming back from England and quarantining at home at the moment. But if I had to hotel quarantine, I would probably have needed to make that decision and then just live with the consequences.
Yeah. OK. Tony O'Brien, former chief executive of the HSE, thanks very much for that very interesting insight. Pat McCann, you were looking at, there's a good piece in the Sunday Times by Mark Tye, Welcome to Hotel Quarantine. Obviously, this is an area of special interest for you, I guess. What are your observations on it?
I suppose the difficulty with this is for the hotel operators in question, that this is not their area of expertise, because essentially they're in the hospitality business and suddenly they're asked to do something that's alien to them. So I have great sympathy for Tifco, the hotel group, who are at the forefront of all of this. It's been very challenging for them, and particularly where you have people who simply don't want to be there, that adds to the issue. So, for example, in Dalata, we've done about 12,000 rooms in quarantine, but they were voluntary. They were in for special work and things like that, so it was relatively easy to do. This is much different. And then where you find that the state has essentially almost opted out of it. They have handed over all of the management of it to a single hotel company, which is creating a lot of difficulty for them. So I think there needs to be more support around that to make it work.
OK, I mean, the army are in there as representatives of the state and everything, aren't they? And there is private security as well, I believe.
Yeah, but if somebody decides they want to leave, there's nobody there that can prevent that happening. because none of the hotel staff have powers of arrest, neither do the army. So essentially, there's issues around that when people decide they're going to go, which they have done, that it's very difficult to prevent that happening. And of course, you know, I was smiling when I saw a piece in the Sunday Business Post this morning about the rules of quarantine. It says, you know, dial 0 for reception, dial 1 for Liveline, dial 2 for the High Court. So it kind of depicts the problem of this and how, you know, I suppose nobody wants to be in this place, but if it's deemed to be a necessity. However, in saying that, we need to be very careful as a country how we're perceived internationally. And I think sometimes, you know, in our quest to do something quickly, we create unintended consequences.
And we have heard a lot from the business sector and the Irish-American business interests. Correct. And also then this there is that necessity to bring in specialist engineers.
Correct.
And stuff for various pharma companies and all these companies that are hugely important to us. So where do you stand on that?
Well, I absolutely believe that there should be a system in place to allow these specialist workers to get in and have some form of system where they're checked or whatever the case may be, and that it's dealt with in a very different way. Because if we don't have these industries working, they may decide, well, you know, it's too risky to be in Ireland, so we'll go somewhere else. And you know, sometimes we have to be careful that we don't, in our exuberance to do something, create a bigger problem for ourselves down the road.
Yeah. Christina, the politics of this, did Fine Gael ever want this?
I would probably say no to that. It seems that this is very much probably one of the most significant headbutting between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael since they both went into government on this. Even before this was rolled out, there was infighting about the news being leaked from the department about the countries that were being added to the list. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Minister Coveney were said to be furious about it and not being informed. And then there were some very intense conversations between officials about how this was going to operate. And then by the end of it, we had this sort of quagmire of regulations and how it was going to work. And from day one, we've had court cases filling up the High Court and people calling Liveline. There's an interesting case there in the newspaper today.
This is a piece of the Sunday Independent with Maeve Sheehan. This is a first person, someone's account. Yeah.
So Philomena Mayer is speaking about her couple of days there in a hotel. She's a healthcare worker who was returning home, and she was basically saying that she had, you know, she had 3 PCR tests in Dubai. She wore masks, kept her distance. But she wasn't out and about in bars or anything like that. She was over visiting her daughter who was sick at the time. And she was just describing sort of the grimness, I think, of being stuck inside.
Nobody said it was going to be any good, did they?
No, but I think it comes back to the argument of when you're going to bring in a law, you have to make sure that it's serving what the purpose of it was. And you know, there's been debates about how the countries get added to the list. There's discussions about variants, high incidence rates. Some countries in the EU are not on it that have very high incidence rates. Some countries in the EU...
I think there's a very specific thing. It's about variants as well. That's the primary driver of it.
Ronan Glynn was in the committee during the week and he was saying that there is a whole range of variants of concern. So I think the debate that is going on in government is the exit strategy of this. If the variants of concern are going to be there forever, if we're going to continue to have mutations of the virus going into this year, into next year, when do you pull the plug on that?
Yeah.
And what
But this was the conversation before we did it as well, but was the clamour to do it that it had to, people had to be done. Like 95% of people in polls wanted it. Well, and then we do it and everybody's freaking out about, this poor lady here.
Discussing the holiday makers and the headlines were hitting about people that were off on their jollies. Well, actually in the reality of it, you have people like healthcare workers coming home. You have people coming home that their parents are dying and they want to go see them and they have to go to the High Court to ask, can they leave a hotel? Obviously those things pull on the heartstrings of everybody. And I just don't think there was proper think through of how this was actually going to work. And I do think that it's kind of the beginning of the end of it. We've had Micheál Martin saying, I think so, over the next, it might last a couple more weeks into months, but they very much have their eye on this green cert passport. You know, there's a clamour from the EU states to get, you know, airlines and flights back open. So I think it'll be a difficult one for Ireland to go out on its own on this one.
But Luke, equally now, Anthony Staines is saying today, I'll apologise now, I forget where, but in one of the papers today, I think possibly the Business Post, is making the point that if we are catching just some people here, he says, I think 10 a day or 10 a week, he says, is enough to keep this pandemic going indefinitely in Ireland. And that if we're catching the variants, and it does seem the Mail today is saying that we are catching people with the Brazilian variant with the mandatory hotel quarantine, that this was the purpose of it. And it is serving its purpose. And it's, you know, it's not perfect, but it's good.
Yeah, it has to be about the variants. As you said, Ben, that's the key thing here. We don't want variants coming into Ireland. New ones as well that might crop up. Now, again, there's low risk of this. There's better evidence, actually. The vaccines will work to some extent against the variants. So the fear is beginning to go a little bit around them, but still it's a fear.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be importing new variants into Ireland, clearly. So if we can catch them...
So do we need it stricter?
Well, if we can catch them by
quarantine?
Testing is obviously the answer. If we can catch them by testing, if it tests before you travel. I mean, and obviously the big thing is the vaccine, let's face it. That's the way out of all of this. Either the vaccine is going to help us or it's not, right? So if people are fully vaccinated, they should be able to come into Ireland and still maybe have tests just in case kind of thing, you know, just in case there's a variant there.
Okay. But again, no, the fully vaccinated, I saw someone making the point that people who are fully vaccinated, they're more likely if they have COVID. I think it was Jerry Killeen or Anthony Staines. They're more likely if they have COVID that it is possibly a variant that is possibly escaping the vaccine.
That's unlikely, as I say.
Okay.
But we know how vaccines work. They don't increase the risk of variants cropping up in general, you see. So we don't worry about vaccination causing variants. In fact, it's the opposite. Okay. Vaccines will stop variants.
But you would be in favour for now of the mandatory hotel quarantine. We need that for now, do we?
I think we do, but it is depressing for people, isn't it, Brendan? These endless debates and every day back and forth, that doesn't help anybody either, you know. So maybe it could have been done much better, perhaps, to make it more consistent, I suppose. But it's a tricky one.
Yeah. And Pat, we obviously bearing in mind that you're a former IBEC and everything else like that, do you think are business dead set against this now, the business community? Are they going to keep hammering at this?
I think it's a case of having to, because there's a lot at stake for Ireland Inc. here. And I do believe that, you know, don't get me wrong on this one. I do think we need to keep our people safe. But equally, we need to look at ways of where we can get the country back up and running again. And I am concerned, and I have a lot of concern as to how we might be over the next number of years if we don't start opening back up our economy again. It's just too risky for us as a society. And I know people will say, do we want a society or an economy? Well, first of all, we need the economy, and we can work on the rest. So,
yeah.
So I do think there's going to be a lot.
We have no economy if we still have COVID circulating around in big numbers.
Correct. And that is the choices we have to make, how we're going to manage our way out of this. And as Luke said on a number of occasions this morning, he said the real way for this is the vaccination programs, and we need to be full tilt at that. And I think some of the ideas around, you know, increasing the length of time between the doses makes a lot of sense to me. I know nothing about what Luke does. I'm in awe of what the man does. But essentially, we need to look at ways as how we can get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
Yeah, there's no doubt that's the simple answer here. Luke, before we go to the break, there's so many questions coming in for you here, but one thing that a lot of people are asking about, I think that people are conflating possibly two things here. One is, what's going on in India? I remember sitting here with Sam McConkie. We were discussing 6 weeks, 2 months ago, a story in the Financial Times where they were suggesting that they thought it had burnt out in India, obviously back with a vengeance. Concern about this, what the new variant is in India, and equally then concern that this variant is kicking off in London, and that the South African variant seems to be, could escape test and trace in London as well. So can you just talk us through some of those?
You've never seen so much science going into something in the history of all of this, on these variants. Massive analysis happening all over the world, studying them, Are there new ones cropping up? What's the risk from them? So there's a huge amount of science happening, and the jury is still out on many of these questions, is the first thing to say. We still don't know.
Okay.
But India is out of control now again, and the big question is why. It's the more transmissible form, the B.1.1.7 is one reason. And remember, that will spread much more effectively. That's one issue there. The second thing is they didn't build up as much immunity as they thought in the first wave of this, in a way. There were still lots of people there who were naive, as we call. This was a second reason for this. So, and it's just a terrible shame, because India did have it under control. Again, what that tells us, Brendan, the virus is still out there. It's in lots of countries. It will flare up like that in different, until we get vaccines into those people.
Okay,
well.
But we don't have to be lie awake at night worrying about what's happening in some areas of London.
No.
Over the last few days.
No, and the variants are interesting. There's a reasonable evidence now that the virus has rolled its dice enough times now, and we have them all in front of us, and we know what they are. That's really good.
Because really, explain that now, because people will be interested in that. It goes so far with variants, is it? And that then, so the B.1.1.7 is the successful winner at the moment.
Exactly.
And that might be...
The virus is sort of sensing our immune system all the time, trying to figure ways around it. And it's got a certain number of tricks that allows it to dodge antibodies or do various things. And now we see them, we know what those dodges are, basically. So it's unlikely there will be new variants that are more, even worse than the ones we have, is one view. Now, again, we don't know, but there's evidence for that. And the best news of all, of course, Ben, is we can vaccinate against the variants.
Okay.
There's a really good case now to give one shot of Pfizer. When you give the second shot in 3 months' time, or 4 or 5 months, use the variants. That's a great strategy, because now you're protected against all the nasty viruses that are out there, and people are considering this plan now.
Okay, so when you say use the variants, that there a new vaccine, with a little bit of the variant in it.
There's a vaccine at the moment which has three variants in it, you know, which you could use today.
Okay, and is that tested, or do they need to be tested?
Hasn't been approved yet. The good news there is the EMA and the FDA have said we will race these through, because they're very similar. You know, you don't need to do another 40,000 patient trial, because they're extremely similar to the one you did the trial on. You know, so they're going to be less stringent in the trials, for good reason. Because you don't need to be astringent.
Okay.
They're looking at a 1 to 2 month period to approve them. It wouldn't surprise me in the next few weeks we'll see the first vaccines against the variants approved for use.
Wow, okay. And then we're into a second generation of vaccines. This is extraordinary. Yeah. Okay, all right. Thanks for that, Luke. And Luke and Christina Finn and Pat McCann staying with us. We're going to take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Luke O'Neill, Christina Finn and Pat McCann still with us. This is a lighter note, but it's a story that a lot of people took a huge interest in. And I think it meant a lot to a lot of people as well who were familiar with UCD or that. And there's kind of a further development in the mystery, if you will, Christina Finn, of Old Man Belfield in the Sunday Independent today.
Yeah, well, everyone will probably remember earlier this year there was sort of an outflow of emotion for this man that's described as Old Man Belfield that was in and around the UCD campus for many, many years. And people sort of retailed a lot of good stories about him and their encounters with him over the year. And he sadly passed away. But
he never spoke, did he?
No, there doesn't seem to be anyone that can really say they had an in-depth conversation, but they just seem to have a soft spot for him. Yeah, and I went to UCD myself and remember, you know, so I just think that there was sort of a soft spot for him. And there's just a big mystery about who he was. And since his passing, a lot of people had sort of tried to perhaps get in touch and say they might have known who he was. And there was a case where apparently a man came forward and questioned whether that he might have been his father he hadn't seen. But apparently DNA tests have ruled that out, and that man just kind of wants to get on with things now. But the Sunday Independent reporting there could be a woman as well that has similar questions about perhaps him being her father. And it just sort of really stands out as an interesting story in terms of where we are in the world, and you can never really get away from anybody now, and everybody knows who you are. You have your Instagram, your Twitter and everything else, and there's just huge question marks over who this man is. Yeah. And everybody just seems to be fascinated with the story and want to know to know more about him.
Yeah, Luke, are you familiar with Old Man Belfield?
Very much so. I mean, someone in my lab, Coach, she works for me, maybe she's listening, she would give him a cup of tea every few days. She lives near Belfield, and she said he was the most amazing person. Just sit there quietly, very benign force. I mean, what strikes me is it's a story of our times, in a way. We all want someone like this, don't we? And it's about that movie Being There. Remember, Brendan, with Chauncey Gardner, there was no record of, I mean, how can someone escape any record or any analysis. It's a complete mystery, isn't it?
Yeah. That's even, even all this DNA and everything. Yeah, it's extraordinary. There will be a movie, won't there?
There will
be a movie. Robin Williams would have played him if he was still alive, but there will be a movie about old man Belfield. Now, look, there was another big... A story this week that was a huge shock, not just to the banking system, I think, but to the business community in general, and to a lot of, to 1,300 workers and to a lot of mortgage holders and bank customers. Pat McCann, what's your take on the KBC story?
I think there's a deeper issue here for us, and the Irish banking sector, and this is only a symptom of really what's going on. Brian Carey has a very good kind of analysis piece in the Sunday Times today, and explains it very well as to why somebody like KBC might decide to pull out of Ireland, and it really looks at the return on equity, and I won't bore your listeners with all of that detail.
Well, I think this detail is important.
Yeah.
We need very tough banking regulations in this country.
We
brought them in because, you know, they were necessary, but they are now in a way making it difficult for banks to operate profitably here. Is that roughly
Yeah,
it?
So, for example, if you look at Ireland versus Belgium, like the return on equity for KBC in Belgium is around 6%. In Ireland, it's -3%. And I'm rounding up numbers now to give you a sense of it. The other thing is, you know, in the area of repossession, Ireland ranks at the bottom in terms of repossessions across Europe. And that creates a problem as well, because that creates a problem on how much capital banks have to maintain. And it's much lower in Europe than it is in Ireland. Now, there's good reasons for all of this, because obviously...
Yeah, you know, look, Pat, people are going to argue that these are good things, like...
Well, yes, but again, I come back to my almost favourite word, unintended consequence of all of that. We'll end up then with a very, very polarised banking system where we really only have domestic banks. And that's really not good for us as a country, either from a retail point of view or from a corporate commercial point of view. So I think we need to rethink what we're doing. Like I'd like somebody in the Department of Finance to start to look at our banking sector and how we see it working over the next 5 to 10 years. This will not be a quick fix. But in the meantime, you know, we pay probably higher mortgage rates than anybody else in Europe. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah, but you see, this is the thing that people can't square with.
Correct.
This. Like, these guys can't say they can't make money here. And we saw Ulster Bank gone for largely the same reason.
Yeah.
But we pay double what anyone else in Europe pays in mortgages. And we all feel that we're paying a lot of banking charges, too.
And you see, what you have to look at is the cost of regulation, the level of capital each bank has to maintain. All of those things are adding to the tale of war around our banking sector. And you can't leave the fact that Goodbody's now will become part of AIB and Davies will become part of one or the other, whether it's Bank of Ireland or Irish Life or permanent TSB, whatever it'll be. So it's this kind of squeezing of the sector.
All right. Thanks for that, Pat. Now, I want to go back to Jenny Bond, who we spoke to yesterday in advance of Prince Philip's funeral, because, as I was saying at the start, I think it was an absolutely extraordinary event, and I think it became for a lot of people in Britain a symbol of a lot of things, and of the grief of the last year, and of that war generation dying off, and all of those kind of things. Jenny, former BBC Royal Correspondent, you're welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
I suppose what we were reminded yesterday is that the royals are really, really good at doing majesty, aren't they? It was extraordinary.
It was. I mean, it was far more moving than I had expected, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I'm used to sort of just straightforward reporting on these events, but it was incredibly intimate, wasn't it? I felt it was almost intrusive that we were looking in on their grief, particularly the Queen's. And I think you're right that a lot of people were living their own stories as they watched, their own stories of this terribly difficult year we've been through and their own lost ones. that they couldn't share in the funeral of, or indeed, as you say, the war generation. This, as you saw from his naval cap on his coffin, this was a man, Prince Philip, who, yes, was consort to the Queen for such a long time, but he was proud of his military service, and it had a great military theme to it and a naval theme.
And you know, you mentioned yesterday about that. I think you said a very sort of striking phrase that these are the hardest days of the Queen's life. But I think that image of the Queen sitting on her own, head bowed there, utterly alone yesterday, was just it was incredibly affecting, wasn't it?
Oh, you'd have had a heart of stone if you didn't feel for her. I was shocked is too strong a word, but struck by the fact that when she got out of the car, she suddenly looked her age, and she walked in rather stooped and then stopped and looked back and seemed a bit uncertain. This was a woman in the deepest grief, and sitting alone made it just so much worse, and the masks made it all seem rather surreal. It was a very beautiful and dignified service, very, very poignant.
And look, I don't mean to drag us all down into the tabloid gutter here now, but let's face it, a lot of people were watching Harry and William yesterday, and a lot of people delighted that they seemed to speak and everything. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would probably say, you know, maybe the media have been making too much of this. But, you know, we know from the horse's mouth, you know, Harry's mouth, that there is a deep rift, that he does feel let down by his father, and that he and William have had one heck of a row, basically. So I still don't understand why they couldn't have had the good grace to walk together in the formal procession. But at least afterwards, when they informally, they decided they didn't want to have the cars, which were all waiting for them, to take them discreetly back to the castle. They said, no, we'll all walk. Charles led the way on that. Apart from the Queen, they all walked. And yes, they walked together. I thought Catherine, Kate Middleton, did really well. Duchess of Cambridge, I could call her.
Yeah.
And she was with them first of all, because they used to be this tight threesome. Then she kind of hung back and left them just walking together. And they did look at ease.
Yeah. And she's segued off nicely there. And indeed, she looked like a future queen as well, didn't she? She looked totally perfect for the occasion. Jenny Bond, thank you very much for coming back on. I will spare our panel giving us their thoughts on the funeral yesterday, but I will thank them. Luke O'Neill, thank you very much. Christina Finn and Pat McCann, thank you both. And it's just after 12 noon, so let's go to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.